Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Dhyanandya podcast. This is Dr. Rewat Dhyanandam, global health epidemiologist. I apologize for the noise behind me if you can hear that. I am recording this from a busy airport, but that has nothing to do with today's topic. Today, we continue on our new special feature where the students of my fourth year international health theory class have produced podcast episodes in which they analyze specific papers that they've chosen. In today's episode, we have four individuals: Quinn Howard, Habon Warsami, Ihab Kandil, and Abdiasis Yalahau. And I apologize if I've murdered any names there. As someone with a strange name myself, I'm sensitive to that issue, so please accept my most profound apologies. I tried. But these four extraordinary individuals have produced an analysis of a particular paper, and the paper they've chosen is The Effect on Mental Health of a Large-Scale Psychosocial Intervention for Survivors of Mass Violence, a Quasi-Experimental Study in Rwanda. As always, you can access this paper if you go to my website, dhyanandan.com, click on podcast, and scroll down to the relevant episode. Also, if you want to ask the podcasters any questions or leave any comments, you can do so on the website or tweet me at Dhyanandan, D-E-O-N-A-N-D-A-N. And without further ado, here are Abdiasis, Ihab, Habon, and Quinn.
Good morning, everybody. This morning, we're going to be discussing a very interesting study coming out of the Netherlands. We're here this morning with Habon, Ihab, and Abdias, and we're going to look specifically at a study out of the University of Amsterdam focused on the effect of mental health in a large-scale psychosocial interventions for survivors of mass conflict, a quasi-experimental study that happened in Rwanda. Habon, could you give me some background on this study? Tell me a little bit about what happened and why the study was, or how the study was carried out.
Sure. So in 1994, there was a genocide in Rwanda when, within a period of 3 months, about 800,000 people were killed and 1 million were internally displaced. Periods of extreme violence, such as this one, can cause serious and prolonged mental health consequences in the population. Usually, post-emergency mental health interventions are aimed at people at risk of psychiatric disorder, but this study is different. So its purpose was to look at the psychosocial interventions, and they did this through a method called sociotherapy, which primarily aims at social bonding and secondarily at mental health improvement. The focus is on stress, on stressful environments, conditions such as division within communities, destruction of social networks, and the resulting loss of social and material support. The idea is that reaching a certain level of mutual respect, trust, and care in a group helps increase the problem-solving capacity and mental health in the group participants. So the researchers predicted that the mental health program participants would improve significantly compared to non-participants.
So can you tell me a little bit about how these researchers carried out this assessment and psychosocial experiment?
Yes. So the study took place in a district in northern Rwanda for a period of 1 year, and the sociotherapy program was community-based. It was carried out by trained Rwandan community leaders, and the groups consisted of 10 to 15 participants of different genders, ethnic backgrounds, and age. And there were 45 groups that ran simultaneously, having three-hour meetings weekly over a period of 15 weeks. They assessed their mental health through a survey developed by the World Health Organization called the self-reporting questionnaire, and it's used for screening for common mental disorders in mostly primary healthcare settings. It consists of 20 yes or no questions about mood, thinking capacity, feelings of anxiety, and physical well-being. So yes answers result in a higher score, meaning a poorer mental health condition. And although the mental health cutoff points vary considerably depending on the structure and culture, setting and culture, a cutoff point of 7 to 8 is widely used. These measurements were taken pre and post intervention, and then also at an 8-month follow-up.
So there were two groups at play here.
Yes, so there's the experimental group, which had 100 adults that participated in the sociotherapy program. There was also a control group, also 100 respondents with similar age, sex, and mental health score distribution to that of the experimental group. However, the control group participants did not participate in the sociotherapy program.
So we've talked about this method and how they carried it out. Now, what were the results that came out of this study? Did they achieve anything, or did we see anything happen of statistical significance?
So the results suggest that the mental health of all participants, both the experimental and the control groups, improved over time based on their questionnaire scores. The effect was significant in women, and it seems to have clinical relevance. The mean questionnaire score of females in the experimental group dropped significantly, ending below the cutoff. Men scoring above cutoff at the start of the study showed a similar trend, but this was not statistically significant. Those in the experimental group who participated in the sociotherapy program showed more improvements than the control group over the duration of the intervention. So the researchers concluded that this large-scale psychosocial intervention, which was primarily aimed at social bonding, caused a lasting improvement in the mental health of survivors of the genocide in Rwanda. So this approach may have similar effects in other post-conflict settings.
So we have here what looks like a successful study and a successful intervention. Ihab, you took a look at the study. Can you tell me a little bit about the qualities and the strengths and weaknesses here?
Sure, I tried to sort of critically assess the study, and one of its main strengths is that it's kind of successfully applied this community-based psychosocial support on its target population. And one of the major challenges in the development of such sort of integrated multi-leveled care systems among populations is you have massive losses, and you have those like breakdown of social support structures. How do you determine when mild or sort of moderate depressive states become psychiatric conditions that require medical attention? And so determining this cutoff point is kind of hard. But as Habon mentioned, the researchers used the SRQ instrument, and this was the first time it was used in such an instance where they were able to track the mental health state of population over time. And so that was a very interesting use of the instrument.
So we're hearing a lot of good things coming out of the study. In your opinion, are there any limitations to this study with design or any bias?
Yeah, when we talk about the results of any study, we have to consider something we call biases, which are factors aside from the actual intervention that could have contributed to the final results we're seeing. We're seeing a first type of bias, which is what we call a reporting bias. As I said, the SRQ instrument was used here for the first time to monitor the health of the population over time. And so to verify the accuracy of this instrument, the researchers in the supplementary material and initial proposal to this project said that they would use other measures to sort of track mental health development over time. So other measurements like social functioning, alcohol use, physical assaults, and psychological aggression, all with the scales to measure them by. But none of these factors were actually measured in the actual study.
So we see some selective reporting going on here.
Yes, but not only that, there's also another thing going on, which is what we call control group bias. And so Habon mentioned that they selected a control group where when they tried to match this control group as closely as possible to the experimental group, where there but there are sort of a couple of problems here in this process. First of all, the control group they selected were from a different district than the actual where the study happened. So the intervention group was from a different district than the actual control group. And so we're not really sure if the control group was subjected to the same level of trauma that the intervention group was subjected to. So that's first of all. Second of all, when you try to sort of create these control groups, you want to make sure that they're matched with the experimental group in every single characteristic you can control, so that we're sure that the results we're seeing are from the intervention and not because of any other social or other characteristics on the control group.
Removing the variables, yes.
Exactly. But what we see here is that when we looked at the table comparing sort of different characteristics of the control versus the actual intervention group, the intervention group had a significantly, statistically significantly higher portion of people that would be categorized as poor. So not only are we seeing selective reporting, we're also seeing problematic issues with whether this control group is truly sort of matching the intervention group
The
per se.
intervention group. That's
Yeah.
very interesting. And you don't, do you see any other issues in terms of influence?
Well, it's interesting when you look at these studies, you always have to look at the funding, right? Because when you look at the funding, you see if there are other aims on why the study was done. When I look back at who funded this organization, this study, it turns out that there's this organization called ORDATE in Netherlands, which is a Catholic organization that focuses on relief and developmental aid. And so, although this organization doesn't fall under the jurisdiction of the Catholic hierarchy per se, it's very interesting to see this connection. We always see an influence of the Catholic Church in areas such as Rwanda and other areas of sub-Saharan Africa. And so it's interesting to see this connection, particularly because Habon mentioned that all these local leaders implementing the programs, they were chosen from the actual community. What's interesting is that the group leader of the whole program was actually a pastor, and we're not sure if the other local leaders are also involved with the church or not. And so we can see how here the sort of how religion may play a big role in this environment, in this intervention specifically. And so we're not really sure whether it's simply just because of the psychosocial intervention or there's a religious influence here involved too.
Very interesting. So, despite these limitations, would you feel comfortable saying the conclusions drawn by the researchers are accurate or fit the population?
Well, the researchers conclude that the study resulted in a lasting improvement of mental health survivors of genocide in Rwanda. I think it's too much. I think what we see here is a positive change in the intervention group over time, and it's something that we should look more into. We should look to see if we can apply the psychosocial program on a larger scale, so on bigger populations and maybe even in a different context. And see where that can lead us, but it's definitely a promising start to psychosocial therapy, specifically sociotherapy.
So we've talked about this control group and the trauma they've undergone, and the country as a whole has undergone a significant amount of trauma. Abdias, can you give us a little bit more insight into what specifically occurred in Rwanda and what maybe is happening to rebuild the society?
Sure. So to preface this, I'll just talk about the conflict. There were two major groups or classes of people in Rwanda. There was the majority Hutu and the ruling class Tutsi. Rwanda was a colony of Germany until the end of the First World War, and then Belgium became the colonizing power. The Tutsi were the ruling class and had a higher social standing than the Hutu, but around the time of independence in 1962, a shift towards a democracy displaced the Tutsi. After independence in 1994, a cycle of violence continued. After the murder of the president, the country of Rwanda experienced a period of extreme violence during the genocidal 3 months. As Habon mentioned, scores of people were killed, 2 million refugees left the country, and about 250,000 to 500,000 women were raped.
So after independence, there was a deficit in administration and a cycle of violence that began within Rwanda. And we're saying that this cycle of violence specifically ended in mental health conditions. Can you tell us a little bit about the prevalence of mental health in post-conflict Rwanda?
Sure. So only a few studies exist to provide mental health morbidity estimates in post-genocidal Rwanda. Bolton and colleagues found that 15.5% of randomly community sampled 368 adults met the criteria for major depression. Farman and colleagues found 24.8 of 2,091 randomly selected adults met symptoms for PTSD.
So Rwanda has a lot of their population currently affected by mental health conditions. Can you tell me, because of this high prevalence, what the needs of this population are?
So the needs of the population fall under four categories, which are economic, political, social, and psychosocial. The economic One is reconstruction tasks. So rebuilding the damaged infrastructure, including homes, roads, bridges, health centers, and schools. In the context of Rwanda, the UN says that the original infrastructure collapsed due to the fighting, and job creation is very important in addressing poverty. Political reconstruction tasks include creating a legitimate government. So in Rwanda, it's integrating the two fighting groups, the Hutu and the Tutsi, and bringing in major players around the area, such as tribal leaders, and settling disputes. The second part in political reconstruction is demilitarization and construction of law and order through civilian police and functioning justice system. Social reconstruction tasks include rebuilding civil society, resettling and integrating displaced people, and establishing awareness of basic human rights. Psychosocial interventions are important in interrupting cycles of violence to provide a climate of peace, building, reconciliation, and sustainable development. This is why the study we're discussing is important.
So we see a very high prevalence in Rwanda and a number of these tasks that are going to be put into place in order to, you know, disrupt this cycle of violence. Are there any special considerations for this population? I understand you're talking about the numbers of orphans and widowed earlier this morning.
Yeah, so it's important to look at the vulnerable population. So there's a lot of people with disabilities due to the violence. There's about 50,000 widows, and a lot of children became orphaned due to the violence. And to look at the population, nearly half of the population is under the age of 16, and the study doesn't really look into that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Abdias, is because we're talking about the qualities of the study. Well, when 40% of the population is under 16 and they're not represented at all in the target population in the study, it raises the question of how effective can this psychosocial intervention be if it's missing out on 40% of the actual population.
Interesting. So we're seeing maybe a study that is meant to be used in the future for the upcoming generation.
Yeah, possibly.
Is this some of the possible implications? Can we talk about the implications of this study? How might this affect both Rwanda and, you know, our understanding of these interventions?
So up until now, most studies concerning psychological trauma relate to PTSD or depression. This project is innovative because it studies the effects of psychosocial intervention that focuses more on social consequences of conflict and war. It promotes the group approach that is tailored to survivors of violence, aiming to restore mutual respect, trust, and mental well-being. And this can be applied to other conflict zones and provides evidence that social intervention benefits the survivors of these conflicts.
That's interesting you should say that. Another important point too is that the study stresses the importance of social and mental well-being in this community. And this concept might be interesting economically. Adias has talked a lot about economic reconstruction. There's an important concept recently introduced by the World Bank, which is the concept of social capital, that explains how social well-being of a specific community and a population can be tightly linked to economic productivity. What we see in post-conflict government in Rwanda is that there are economic difficulties, of course, and ramifications, the health ramifications are enormous. But we do need to spend more money on basic health services, but sort of the concept of social capital and the findings of the study sort of implicate our other needs, so that we need to place more, we need to invest more in services that address mental health issues of the population.
So Ihab, what I hear you saying is that mental health really has become an important disease in the global conversation. And when we talk about disease importance, we need to now include mental health on that list, along with HIV and malaria. And when we talk about HIV, when we talk about mental health, we want to talk about how it impacts the individual, the community, and what the effects in the society may be.
Yeah, so talk to us about that, Quinn. So we're talking about disease importance. How is that important for an individual in living in this community?
So individuals, we're going to see a little bit of social dislocation that happens. These individuals do not feel well, and they don't connect well with society. And the way the symptoms manifest create an inability of individuals to productively engage in that society.
Okay, so how would this impact society in general?
So the lack of engagement, you're going to see a double isolation factor here.
Okay.
The symptoms are going to isolate the individual from the community, but the stigma around the symptoms will act to further isolate those two concepts. And what we see is this dislocation, this mistrust, degrades group dynamics. And if we have degraded group dynamics, we're going to hinder the rebuilding of a post-conflict society.
So let's put this into perspective. How do these factors sort of increase the effect of the global burden of disease in general? How do they play into that?
Well, yeah, we're seeing an increased rate of mental health issues on our, radar when we talk about prevalence of disease. So we first need to talk about the enormous amount of people currently exposed to this kind of trauma. There are 64 countries experiencing ongoing violence with 573 active guerrilla and separatist groups. This is a huge population at risk of developing these disorders, and a large number that is un may unknowingly be suffering from past exposure. So when we talk about mental health again, we're going to talk about how it is now representative of 14% of the global burden of disease, and how depression, a previously unrecognized disease, is now 9.8% of the total disease burden in low-income countries, with the WHO estimating that 800,000 people commit suicide every year.
So within sort of the greater context of global health, you think that we're undergoing a disease transition here?
I really do. As the countries grow up in terms of their development, we increase the lifespan of individuals. And when you increase that lifespan, you're going to see an increase in chronic conditions. The only issue is we have developing countries who are still dealing with those communicable diseases, but have seen an increase in chronic conditions. So this disease transition is going to become very important for how we address public health in the future.
Yeah, I mean, traditional indicators of public health, like maternal figures of maternal health and infant mortality rate, that they no longer describe the health status of whole societies. Non-communicable diseases you mentioned are sort of getting the greater attention of the world right now. The problem is when one thinks about challenges in developing countries, diseases like HIV, AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, and other tropical diseases quickly come to mind. But few think of mental health, despite this burden you mentioned over
So,
here.
FGS, do you feel as though we're going to see a switch to mental health, or do you believe that communicable diseases are still the most important issue?
Yeah, I still think communicable diseases are pretty important in the world. In Rwanda, we talked about the amount of rape that went on, about 250,000 women that were raped during the genocidal period. 67% of those women developed HIV and AIDS. That's a big burden on the society. So I think we need to better utilize the limited funds we have in saving lives.
I'm not sure. I'm not. So sorry to interrupt you there, Corinne. But I'm not sure if we should. I think there should be a significant shift in funding to mental health condition, or more like a reasonable redistribution of resources. In fact, like when you look about developing countries, three quarters of those afflicted with mental disorders actually live in developing countries, but only an estimated of 85% of those suffering from severe mental illnesses in those developing countries do actually receive their needed treatment. These figures are according to the World Health Organization. So what we see here is an unequal distribution of resources. When you look, I'll give you something, just an example to elucidate that. So when you look at the European region, there are 200 times as many psychiatrists in Europe than in Africa. That's according also to the World Health Organization. So we see an unequal distribution of resources here, even though the significant portion of mental illness is in developing countries. Most of the resources are available in developed countries.
So, Abdias, would you then argue for a shift in diseases fighting communicable disease first and then a transition into more chronic conditions?
Yeah, because we need to first preserve lives, right? Four of the top six causes of death in Rwanda are still infectious diseases, acute respiratory infections, HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis are still killing a lot of people in this region.
So we've heard from Abdias and Ihab. Haban, could you give me any concluding thoughts or last arguments for the context of this study in the global discussion on health?
Well, in the wider discussion of global health, this study shows that we need to improve the accessibility and quality of mental health treatment around the world, particularly in low-income countries and underserved populations. We need to develop local expertise and facilities for mental health education, research, and training in these low-income countries. We need to ensure social equity in mental health care, and there needs to be an effective, affordable, and accessible mental health care for all people in all societies, regardless of socioeconomic status, race, gender, or religion.
So what I'm hearing out of the three of you is a lot of interdisciplinary action that needs to happen. You know, several disciplines are going to need to come together in order to collaborate and effectively solve this problem. We see the clinical side in that these individuals do require treatment, and it's a large population with abominably high statistics of mental illness. But the prevalence of this, the large number, also means that this needs to become a public health issue and be acted upon on a public health level. So where do we see this social fitting, or this social study fitting, is both in the movement of being able to understand prevalence within a society and then understanding the ramifications on a social level of prevalence, of high prevalence of mental health in these conflicted regions. So in conclusion, we see mental health coming up as an emerging issue in sub-Saharan Africa and in the globe. The number of individuals afflicted, both past and present, makes it an enormous issue that does need to be addressed. And this study does facilitate a way to identify and track mental health conditions in post-conflict regions. And social therapy does demonstrate a new way of dealing with mental health issues in sub-Saharan Africa. The global implications of this are increased recognition of the prevalence of mental health issues and perhaps a shift in dialogue to addressing these issues on a more global scale. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Quinn.